Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Signature Symphony opens its season with jazz trumpeter Byron Stripling in a program devoted to the era of hot jazz, the Roaring Twenties, and all that jazz. Stripling is a veteran jazz performer who started his career in the bands of the last great band leaders of the big band era, Lionel Hampton, Woody Herman, Count Basie, Louis Belson, and Buck Clayton. From there, he played the lead in the Broadway-bound musical Satchmo in 1987 and 88, and became a fixture in the New York jazz scene for several decades, performing with jazz at Lincoln Center, the Carnegie Hall Jazz Orchestra, and the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestras, before leaving New York to head up the Columbus Jazz Orchestra in Ohio, one of the country's most successful nonprofit jazz orchestras. As well, Stripling has been a frequent Pops guest with orchestras around the country, from the Boston and New York Pops to the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra and the Seattle and Dallas Symphonies, just to name a few. Here he is from one of his recordings, playing and singing the standard, "I Can't Give You Anything But Love."
Now I can't give you anything but love, baby. Now that's the only thing I've plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find, yeah, now happiness. And I guess all those things you always pine for. Now, gee, I'd like to see you look.
That's my guest today, jazz trumpeter and vocalist Byron Stripling, who will be appearing with the Signature Symphony tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 at the Vantrees Pace. Byron Stripling is my guest today. Byron Stripling, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Welcome back to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a joy to be here with you.
Yeah, you're going to be opening the Signature Symphony season tonight and tomorrow, mm-hmm. and doing a tribute to hot jazz in the 1920s. And as I was thinking about this program, we're familiar with you doing tributes to Louis, and this is sort of like that, but it's more of the foundational music.
Right. Good way to describe it. Well, you know, I have over 7 symphony shows, and the Louis Armstrong one is very popular, but this one is actually a new sort of way of thinking about it, too. As you mentioned, the 20s is a foundation for the beginnings of jazz and also great American music. One of the things that the great Cole Porter did is, as he was traveling around Europe, he heard something and about something that was percolating in America, and that was the Charleston. And that was just this little beat, boom, boom, chugum, boom, boom. And so he heard about it in Europe and was so excited by those rhythms and the jazz that's involved in that, that he had people in Europe show him the dance and those kind of things. And then that became imbued in his great music. So what we know is that that's sort of the beginning of this jazz age that has then evolved into where we are now with jazz. We just wanted to demonstrate the beginnings of that with this concert. And we call it the Roaring Twenties and All That Jazz. And then further go into the things that became jazz and also how they have a real influence on American music today, including, I should say, gospel music, because before there was blues, there was even gospel. And so it's been one of the great ways that as Americans that we celebrate, and it's a traditional way of uplifting ourselves. And so we want to incorporate all that stuff, blues, jazz, gospel, and sort of put them into one and shake them up and create a great program.
Yeah. Now, you do a lot of symphony programs now, symphony programs. How do you go about creating something like this? Or when you're trying to put music together, what sort of things are you thinking about?
Well, so there's two things. First, what inspires me? Then usually from that I can find what inspires others. And then you have to find the correct choice of music, the correct choice of theme, then the correct choice of arrangers, the correct choice of people that I want to join me. In this case, I'm very happy to present on the drums Bob Breithaupt and the great Bobby Floyd on piano and organ. And whenever he plays, that's all people remember, because he's truly, in fact, I feel it's hard to play with him because he becomes the star of whatever show he plays in. So it's all those things coming together, and you're trying to create a program Because here's what we know is that music can change people's lives. It can, as I've said, it can uplift them. It really provides food for the soul, valuable nourishment for any community. And if you think about anything in your life, you usually soundtrack it with music. So when you hear, for me, it's when I was my first girl I dated, we were listening to Billy Joel's Just the Way You Are. Whenever I hear that, I get like a little tear. She was such a little cute girl, right? And so what we know in birth, in death, and throughout the continuation of our lives, there's some music that's there to uplift us. And what we know now, and I, you know, as much as I'd like to ignore the fact that we have horrible floods and storms going over now, I know that music is going to be the thing, regardless of racial divisions, income divisions, and all those things, political. It's music that can bring us for that moment. The great William James of Harvard said, I sing not because I'm happy, but I'm happy because I sing. And so what we know is the mere act of getting people together, singing for them, singing with them, singing together, brings people together. And for that minute, when the voice is activated, we really do become one. That's like a cliche phrase, but music does that for people. It's almost like a meditation. You're not thinking about how you don't like this or that. It's like we can hold hands, become one, and sing together. And that is really my mission right now in life. That's what this concert will do for people.
And really, you're featuring a lot of music. First of all, you're setting a high bar.
That's always good to do.
But really, a lot of the music on this concert is very much toe-tapping music. People have heard most of these tunes, Down by the Riverside.
Yeah.
St. James Infirmary,
We opened
Closer Walk with Thee.
Closer Walk with Thee. Then we started with Irving Berlin's Alexander's Ragtime Band. I mean, so this is all stuff. It's Americana, but it's also uplifting and inspiring, which is my goal always when we play.
Yeah. Of course, to really make a symphony pops program, you really depend on arrangers, and you have some really good arrangers, Dennis Macrell.
Mm-hmm.
How
did you know Dennis Macrell? You're very smart. You just impressed me.
He's a great drummer.
Yes, he is.
And Manny Album. Who's no longer with us, but
yes.
Really an amazing.
You're just trying to impress me with your knowledge of these great arrangers. We also have Jeff Tyzik, who's one of the premier arrangers. He just spoke to him this morning. He's the director of the Pops director of the Detroit Symphony, the Dallas Symphony, the Rochester Philharmonic, the Florida Orchestra, so many others. He is one of the premier arrangers in the country.
Now, you mentioned this show is one of your newer shows. How long does it take to put something like that together as far as conception?
And then you have to fall down and realize as you're in front of an audience, ooh, that didn't work. Or maybe it did, and you keep that, and then you discard the things that don't work. So it takes a long period of time. You're always shaping, molding, and sculpting the musical product because you want to get it just right for the audience. Concert is really like a piece of music. It has its ups and downs, its fast and slows, and you want to create something that takes people on a magical journey. And if we do what we do correctly, if we do it well, I think the goal really is that when people leave, they feel differently. They won't know why. But my goal was when people leave a concert, and I've seen this happen in Mozart, Brahms, Mahler, and Stravinsky. I've seen it happen in Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Dizzy Gillespie. People leave a concert, and I think they're actually nicer to each other because there's something that happened, and it's a weird word, spiritually, within the music. It has nothing to do with religion or anything, but just a spiritual thing that happened. The theater is a magical place, and I feel it's my responsibility as a musician to provide that nourishment for community through music. It's what I do. If I'm an evangelist, it's a musical evangelist.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about your career, you know, you started out as a traditional jazz musician playing as a sideman and then eventually becoming a leader, but you've had these other experiences that sort of shape you into the sort of the musician you are today, which is, you know, you've probably played in Broadway pit orchestra, so you sense that sort of musical experience.
Mm-hmm.
You've also been a lead performer in a Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about just crafting your show. I would assume it's very much like the way you put together Saturday.
Exactly right. So what I do because I also conduct a professional jazz orchestra, what I do when I put together programming, whether it's for orchestra or for my own bands or my own shows with my quartet, I think of it like what elements I could put using theater and only to inspire or to inform the musical part of it. So I can, it helps me with those ups and downs and the shape of the show. So my shows move fast. There are talking periods when I talk. There are periods when it's all music. Usually the first few songs, it's just music. Like, you know, I want people to bathe in the beautiful sounds that we hope to create and have that change them. Well, then we talk to them and we open It's like, to me, you come and you approach this with open arms. You let people come to the music. That's why if I were an orchestra conductor for classical, I'd be introducing the oboe player and say, hey, did you guys dig John playing the oboe solo? Stand up, John. Give him a big round of applause. Man, you played your tail off. Oh, baby, come on. Give John. John, stand up again. And the first cello, check out the first cello player's shoes. Check him out. You know, I would have it, but be like you're in my living room. Because I think, and then I get to know these people, classical or jazz or whatever. It, to me, doesn't take away from the dignity of the music. And the beautifulness, I just want to have the environment be welcoming for people. So I use those elements of theater, to your point, to get across. And people, other people do it different ways. That's my way of doing it.
My guest today is a jazz trumpeter and a musician, Byron Stripling. He'll be kicking off the Signature Symphony Pop Series with two performances, the 1920s.
The Roaring Twenties and all that jazz.
Yeah. And it takes place tonight and tomorrow at the Vantry's Pace. A little bit of a tribute to Louis Armstrong as well. And, of course, we associate you because of being in Satchmo. Mm-hmm. And also, you've done a lot of programs devoted to Louis Armstrong. I want to ask you a question. Back to when you were a young trumpet player, was Louis Armstrong the first trumpet player you went to, or did you only find him later in your development?
Sort of both. So my father had the record Hello, Dolly.
Okay.
And I listened to that all the time. My father and our whole family, which is why I love music so much. Music, which is was such a powerful force in our lives. My father was the choir director, so I was heard that great music. He was a classical singer, actually, my father. So I heard and went to concerts. You know, we didn't have a lot of money, but Dad took us to see Leontine Price, Beverly Sills, Marilyn Horne, Pavarotti, so many people. We heard great orchestra music constantly. He was constantly playing. But in the nights after my father worked really hard, he always put on Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, Clifford Brown. He loved Duke Ellington, you know, had all this jazz playing, and he loved Louis Armstrong, too. So I heard Louis Armstrong from the late period, you know, 60s.
And it was very much a commercial music.
Commercial started music, but still the sound of that trumpet was still amazing to me and really grabbed hold of my ear and took me on a journey for which I will never forget. Then later, I found the 1920s Louis Armstrong.
Right, and that's the whole thing is I found, like, you almost have to be of a certain age and maturity, really, to understand what Louis Armstrong was doing. And it's also sort of like listening to Charlie Parker a lot of times. If you grew up after Charlie Parker, you heard everybody imitating, you know, incorporating his language. Then when you actually first hear Charlie Parker, you say, well, I've heard that before. And you have to realize that nobody played anything close to that, before, you know, the first time. And I think the same with Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, I agree.
And when you're taking it back another 20 years and the recording's even scratchier and it's, you know, you have to even listen closer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually I've been thinking that maybe is a gift that the fidelity. You know, one thing I learned when the older guys told me, listen to Louis Armstrong, the old Louis Armstrong. I was like, okay. And I listened to them. And the first thing I realized was that music that was recorded in the 1920s sounds like it was recorded in the 1920s, right? So you're not going to. So it actually forces you to center in to try to get beyond that scratchiness and the fidelity.
In fact, sounds like it was recorded into a can, which it probably was,
right? So that's actually good for us. And it's one thing I like to emphasize to people that are beginning that journey.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I notice, and you've been doing this for a number of years, is you know you sing and play trumpet. I've been going down to New Orleans for the last few years, and I know all these trumpet players. And when they're in New Orleans, all of a sudden, if you're a trumpet player and you lead a band, you have to sing. And I assume that goes back to Louis, right?
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
I mean, even guys that you never knew could sing, they're singing.
Well, look, there's two parts to that. So I remember Clark Terry told me the advice Louis Armstrong gave him. He said, Pops, you got to always sing. And so Clark Terry said, well, why? I said, you save your chops. So, you know, the trumpet is, as Doc Severinsen likes to say, the trumpet is the jealous mistress, and it always wants your full attention. So if you're not, you know, you always want to get that mouthpiece away from that mistress and be able to just rest your lips a little bit. And so singing will do that. The part two that Clark Terry told me, he says, I've been playing the trumpet and the flugelhorn all my life, and I'll play a concert, and I'll feel like I gave my best concert. And the only thing people will talk about after that concert is, boy, I sure did love the way you mumbled and sang that tune. So he says, knowing that, you probably should start adding singing to your repertoire.
Were you a natural singer to begin with?
Well, I always sang in my father's choirs in church, so that was the beginning for me, and then it
evolved. That's another. What you're doing today is just completely different. I mean, it's one thing.
Well, actually, my church was pretty liberal. You could basically sing, and that's the association, and maybe I'll talk about it at the performance. I haven't decided about the line between the blues and gospel is very thin, right? And so when I first heard Ray Charles or Aretha Franklin, I was like, are they singing jazz or gospel, right?
Right.
You hear when Ray Charles sings Georgia, it's just singing a gospel song, you know? So same with Aretha Franklin, whose father, the great C.L. Franklin, who was a good friend of Martin Luther King's, her training was in the church. And it's so interesting because some of these people would be kicked out of the church for singing pop music, particularly Sister Rosetta Thorpe, who made Down by the Riverside really popular. They'd be kicked out for singing pop music. Then they'd let them back in, and they'd get kicked out again. So.
Right. And that continued all the way through the 60s, yes. I think, with Al Green.
Yep. The Staples Singers, the people said, why do you sing I'll Take You There? That great, you know, hit they recorded. And I talked to Mavis Staples about that. She goes, I'm talking about the Lord, actually, when I say I'll take you there. Take you to heaven.
Well, my guest today is Byron Stripling. He'll be kicking off the Signature Symphonies pop series with two performances tonight and tomorrow at 7:30, featuring great music from the Roaring Twenties, and some of it even actually goes back quite a bit before.
Go back before and we go beyond.
Yeah, and everything, as you might expect, When the Saints Come Marching In, Down by the Riverside, mm-hmm. Sweet Georgia Brown. Just a toe-tapping selection of music, I think.
Yeah, you know, years ago they asked Count Basie, they said, how do you describe your music? And he said three words. He said, pat your foot. And I think that's always been my goal, too, learning from playing in that band. And so that's my first goal. If I can get you to pat your foot, I can get your whole body involved in the music, and then you begin to feel good.
Yeah. Now, I know you were in the Count Basie band with Thad Jones leading it and Frank Foster.
Yes,
did you actually get to play with Basie before?
Basie passed right before I joined.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That must have been.
But it was pretty cool because I got to play with people like Freddie Green and so many
and
of
And
the
nearly
other
everybody who'd been with him. And that was a band that stayed together for decades.
Forever. The guys were, you know, I went in there and the guys had been in there 25 to 30 years, some of them. So they had seen everything. I couldn't impress anybody. Hard to impress a guy. It's like when I played for Woody. I was in Woody Herman's band, and you know, you think you're trying to impress your leader and make him happy. He just looks at you like almost asleep. He's like seen everything, man. You can't impress him.
Yeah. Well, close to 15 years ago, you moved from New York to Columbus, and what I've noticed is a lot of musicians that say in a generation or two ago, who would have always stayed in New York. They did the same thing. It was like, you know, and now you see, and they'll still perform in New York, and I know you do too, but they're living everywhere now. Mm-hmm. What was the reason for you going to Columbus?
Two words, cheaper rent.
That simple?
No, it's certainly, first of all, I think one of the great things in traveling that you experience is every town. And now in this case, I'll talk about Tulsa. Every town has amazing musicians who've chosen to live there because that's where they live. So New York to me is a mecca. It is probably the greatest city in the world. There's an energy there that the great thing is you can take it with you. And so New York is always in my heart. I love the city. My daughter decided to go to college there. She loved it so much. So she goes to college. And the first thing she did, she lives 40 miles outside. First thing she did was they took a trip into the city, go see a show. Da, da. Mm-hmm. But it is cost prohibitive. I mean, let's just be honest. And I don't even know how they're going to sustain what they're trying to do because I can't even buy my old house. I couldn't even buy it back, you know. So there's something that's got to be figured out with that. Having said that, again, it's the greatest city in the world and so much there. And I feel I take the spirit and the energy of New York with me.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing is, like, you know, there are all these guys that were first call in New York and now they're living in, you know, Evanston, Illinois, mm-hmm. or Columbus, Ohio, or Denver or somewhere. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, that energy sort of infuses the mm-hmm. local music scene,
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely.
I mean, not to say that they're not great musicians wherever there are. But there's something about that sort of...
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing. Los Angeles has great music, but look, Indianapolis has the Indianapolis sound with, you know, Slide Hampton and yeah. all the guys that came out of there. Columbus has its own sound. Memphis has its own sound.
Tulsa has its own sound.
Tulsa has the Tulsa thing, yeah, you know. Yeah. And Oklahoma has a great tradition of jazz, you know. Yeah. So I never want to cheapen other areas. And I just, there's an energy I can get from Tulsa while I'm here. I'm going to try to grab that. And I feel blessed to be here and take that spirit of Tulsa with me, as well as bring New York with me and Columbus and all those others.
Now, since you've been in Columbus, you've been running the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, which is perhaps one of the most successful American sort of repertory jazz orchestras. I would have to say it goes back to the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did you get involved with them?
Well, you should know, first, this is the 45th anniversary of the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. We'll celebrate that starting in October with a concert celebrating that. And I'll have John Clayton co-conducting and writing things, and Joshua Rettman being our soloist for that concert. So 45 years, realized that the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, probably the most famous of them all, only about 25-plus years. So we had them beat, and our founder, Ray Eubanks, had the vision to do this way before anybody else. Only direction we've changed is we're not necessarily repertoire. We are open to all types of music. I encourage the creation of new music.
Yeah, I use the repertoire, but it's new music as well, yeah.
So anything. So we're going to play Duke Ellington, but we also play Billy Joel. Mm-hmm. We also play Latin music. We'll play, basically, I'll try anything, and I feel jazz musicians have always been open to the influences of others, and if we don't involve that, then we're not playing homage to Dizzy Gillespie, who went to and heard the music of Chano Pozo in Cuba and put that into his music. We're not doing service to Stan Getz, who went and found the bossa nova and put that into his music. We're not honoring Chick Corea and some of the great musicians who put rock and roll beats into their music and they fused them with jazz. So this is nothing new that we're doing, and we want to continue to look forward, playing jazz in its most traditional ways and adding those things that help us. And music is always, if it's organically fused together, not forced, then we always come up with great new things.
Now, you played in Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra for mm-hmm. a while, and also Carnegie Hall mm-hmm. Jazz Orchestra, which I have to admit, I like that band a little better. It's just something about it was, you know, mm-hmm. just his personal preference. But that, of course, Lincoln Center's still going, but Carnegie Hall, that fell apart eventually. What did you learn from playing in those experiences that you can add to leading Columbus Jazz Orchestra?
Well, it's a great question. You know, so not only, but I was also playing the Smithsonian Jazz Band.
That's true.
I was soloing with military bands and continue to do all those types of things. Basically, you learn about leadership and those elements needed to try to sustain an organization. There are commercial elements that one needs to involve, and there's an openness to your audience and what they need, what gets people in the seats. You know about funding and how you need to talk to people to help you with that.
Because and that was, you know, that was the problem with Carnegie, wasn't it?
It's hard. That's the problem with every band, and it's a continuous problem where you might for a season think, hey, we're doing pretty good here. We fill our houses basically 80 to 90% every concert in the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, yet we still need help.
Right.
Because to have a staff and to have 18 musicians on stage and guest soloists and rent the hall and pay the stage hands
and arrangers
and all that.
Most of the time you're doing original arrangements.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
So it requires, and that's why we're so thankful for the people who are aware of that. And people should be aware of that. You know, the audience ticket does not pay for all those amazing musicians that you see on stage. So we need a little bit of help. This has happened since the time of Bach, who was subsidized by the church, right?
right.
They say, hey, write this.
Mozart worked for the archbishop.
Right. There you go. So this is not anything new, and I don't want people to realize that. But if we do what we do, as I've always said throughout this conversation, if I do what I do correctly, we have the chance to provide people with some music that will endure forever and a day. We record and stuff, we do simulcasts. Now it's important for us to keep, and these are the things I learned, that everything that we do, even though we're financially challenged, that's not an excuse to try to keep up with where people are going with their habits of listening. You know, no more CDs, streaming, internet simulcast. Is it okay for somebody to film a little bit of your performance? Used to say no, maybe good now. Maybe having somebody see you on social media is a positive, not a negative. So just trying to work through all those things and having the musicians have an openness to do the same thing.
Your jazz orchestra is one of the most successful here in the United States, but it's one of a handful. And you go to Europe, you know, every city's got a, not only do they have a state-funded symphony, they have a, many cities have a state-funded jazz orchestra. You look in Scandinavia, even little tiny towns have these amazing jazz orchestras. Mm-hmm. Do you think America will ever be like that? Or do you see the other side where that funding's not going to continue in Europe?
Well, so a little bit of both. I mean, it is developing a culture where the arts are important. So you and I have already had a chance to talk about why we think art is important. And it's important to emphasize that the reason this is confusing to people, why music is important, why the arts is important, is because what we sell, it's important, what we sell is invisible. We sell a feeling. It's not tangible. You can't hold a concert in your hand. But as I've said before, the gift and the experience and how you feel before and after. And so it's hard to get funding for that if your only exposure to music has been rock on the radio, if your only experience of music and your only way of receiving music has been through YouTube, would be a lot of kids.
Right.
You know, I give lectures to kids. I give concerts to kids. Or I'll go and give, I'm going to go and with the Tulsa Junior College here and go give them a little clinic, and I'll probably play a little bit for them. Probably when I start playing, everybody will pick up their phone and record me. And what I've got to do is convince them to put down their phone and experience me to you, not through your phone, but me to you, and give you an emotional experience of music. And that's something that can be taught. So I think it's the culture, survival of the arts and survival of what we do is basically based upon the cultural importance. So I have to, my responsibility in that, because I can't, I can talk to a politician and change them, although they don't want me in their office because I don't have any money for them. But I can get into. But if you can get me to them, I'd rather play for them than talk to them. Right. And if I can reach them and get them to open their hearts, right, without the thought of the political or the financial thing for them, because they'll tell me blatantly, I'll help you if you can get me some advertisement. Yeah. If you will mention this or that, or if you will tell them that I help, because they're looking to get elected. But I have to tell you, the heart and music and art and life and morality go far beyond your next election. So if we can convince people of that, then we can get them to open their hearts. Then we don't have to have a discussion about, is it okay for us to help the people who are being hurt by this flood?
Mm-hmm.
That should not be a discussion. And I believe music can help with that discussion because it gives you a chance for openness, gives you a chance to open that place in you that's not about prejudice. It's not about anything but love. That's why we do what we do. I'm verbalizing it now, but music speaks it so much better. And when I play and people cry, I know I've reached their hearts.
Well, it sounds like that's the goal for this weekend, right?
That's what we will do this weekend.
All right. Byron Stripling, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for joining
us. Joy to talk with you.
Jazz vocalist and trumpeter Byron Stripling speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll open the Signature Symphony 2017-2018 season tonight and tomorrow with concerts at 7:30 at the Van Treese Pace. For more information, visit signaturesymphony.org. We're going to leave you with more music by Byron Stripling. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher.
Yeah, Dinah, anyone finer? State of Carolina, if there is and you know her, won't show to me a diner where there's Dixie eyes blazing. I love to see him gazing through the eyes of Dinah Lee. Now, baby, every night, why do I shake with fright? Because my diner might change your mind. Shove that lemon of oil. Change your mind, left my dynamite. I have an old liner. Yeah, diner, oh, diner. Oh, Dinah, oh, babe, Dinah Lee. Watch this one. Dinah, do, 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 yeah. Mama Dinah Lee. Oh, baby, every night, why do I shake with fire? Because my dynamite.